You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily Cleveland Cavaliers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hey, Chris Manning from Locked On Cavs here. Today's show is kind of a long one. So first, you're going to hear Jeff Siegel from Early Bird Rights and Peachtree Hoops helping me analyze the Jetty Osman extension. In case you missed the news from last week, Jetty has signed a four-year, just under $31 million extension with the Cavs. That's going to keep him here through theoretically 2024. Could be earlier than that because depending on the last year of the deal, it's non-guaranteed, so the Cavs could let him go. That's a really great deal for the Cavs. I think it's a very team-friendly contract. Jeff and I get into that. You're also going to hear from Ty Windish, the host of the Eurostep podcast, who has his own Patreon where he breaks down every NBA roster move. Over on that Patreon, you can check out what we're going to talk about with the Bucks. The Eurostep podcast, in case you didn't know, covers Giannis and the Bucks. So we're going to get into everything going on there as the Cavs play Milwaukee 8 p.m. on Monday night. Lastly, the other thing going on right now is John Henson is out 2 to 4 weeks with a hamstring. He came back and played his first game in about a year on Saturday against the Pacers, the Cavs home opener. The Cavs in general were great in that game. The ball movement was great. The shooting was great. The defense actually came up really well. They held on even when Indiana really mucked things up in the second half. A very, very good win. Good games from basically everyone who played. Kevin and Tristan Thompson in particular were utterly fantastic, with Tristan maybe having one of the best games he's ever had in the regular season, and Kevin just looking much more comfortable, looking like the Kevin level, the really feasting, especially when Domantas Sabonis was out and he could just bully TJ Leaf in the post. So very good game for the Cavs. We'll see if they can build on that this week. You have Milwaukee Monday, Chicago Wednesday, and then a game on Friday as well to kind of wrap up a busy week. But John Henson being out is a little bit of a bummer. I thought he looked good on Saturday. We'll see what happens. We'll see what this could mean. Let's say Dylan Windler plays this week. Maybe. We don't really know yet. But if he comes back and the Cavs play smaller, what does that mean for Henson? What does it also mean for Ante Zidic on the line? Just some interesting little questions there to consider. We'll see what that kind of means for the Cavs. But here's first up Jeff Siegel and then T. Windish from Eurostep. Talk to you guys tomorrow after Cavs Bucks. All right, Jeff. So let's talk about Jetty Osman, his extension. His extension to me, when it comes out, it was past like the quote unquote deadline, which I think it's just basically, tell me if I'm wrong about this, it's just like an artificial deadline, basically.
There is no deadline for guys Osman. Like it's not an artificial deadline. It just doesn't even exist. The deadline for him really is June 30th, the day before he would have been a free agent.
Okay. So Jetty signs this four-year extension. It's average value like $7.75 million a year. Starts at $8.75 next year. Goes down to $8.05 in 2021, 2022. Goes down again to $7.35 in 2022, 2023. And then in 2023, 2024, there's a non-guaranteed year, which I believe is all non-guaranteed, for $6.65. So basically, he's getting the most money up front. It declines. That's actually a thing Kobe Altman has really done. The last couple extensions he's agreed to, notably Kevin Love and Larry Nance, really the only two, they've all done that. Nance starts at 12.7 this year, goes down to 9.6 by end of it. Kevin starts at 31 next year. It ends at a little under 29 in 2022, 2023, assuming he would be on the team at that point. Jeff, I wouldn't say, for me, when I saw this, I was surprised at the number. I don't think it's unreasonable. I don't think this is a number that's like too high. I think if Jetty works out to some level that we kind of think he can, or at least I think he can, I think it's a pretty fair value. What was your just initial reaction in looking at what the 4 year, a little under $31 million that Jetty's getting here?
Yeah. I mean, certainly when it came out that it was 4 for $31 million, that was already a pretty low number compared to what I thought he could have gotten on the restricted market next summer. You know, particularly because 2020 is so lacking in talent, to say the least. You know, I thought he could have played his way into a bigger deal than that. We know that he is going to start on this team for most of this year, and that's going to hold a lot of water. I mean, he's just going to have the minutes, you know, 30, 35 minutes a game throughout this season, just like he did last year, where he can really prove what he can do as a, you know, starter, sixth, seventh man level kind of player. And this deal pays him like a seventh or eighth man on a good team, but he may be better than that. And so it seems like he took this deal based on, you know, his talent level right now without baking in the opportunity that he might be better than that. And I think that was where I was surprised. And then of course it comes out that the last year is non-guaranteed. So really he's only got, you know, like $25 million in guaranteed money, 24, 25 million. And that's just, I mean, that's, it makes it even more team friendly and even more sort of head scratching as to why Osman would want this deal.
I think in the context too of the other deals we saw get done this contract season, you know, you had, Buddy Hield gets a bunch of money. Jaylen Brown gets a bunch of money. Now Jetty's not on their level. I don't think he was ever going to get super close to that, but like what you saw those guys get was more money than it seemed like their offers got bumped up at the last minute. They got some incentives. They, you know, got a good amount of guaranteed money and they still get to hit free agency before they're 30. So I think Jetty gets like the, he will be a free agent before he's 30 and he's 24 now. He will not turn 25 until basically at the end of the season, April 5th. He's got time to like grow into this. If he's 29, hits free into market, he'll be in a good position to get another good contract if he ends up working out, or you know, maybe he goes to Europe or whatever at that point. Like he should be at the very least like a serviceable NBA player. Again, I don't think he should have gotten Buddy Hield money or Jaylen Brown money, but I'm surprised like he didn't end up getting like double, like 10 million plus starting out at least, like maybe like 10 and then going down from that, or just something in that realm. And I think also I'm just surprised by the guaranteed year at the end. To me, when I see that, I think maybe it's because the J.R. Smith contract was really the kind of explainer for me in this and learning about the value of that. But it's really always usually as an escape hatch for the team. That's never something the player is normally ever really going to benefit from. You know, it's the way for the Cavs to clear money off their books, and not that they really will necessarily need to, because their cap's going to, as of right now, is fairly open in that year. That's just like when Windler and KPJ and Garland are going to be restricted free agents. So maybe like that's where the thinking comes in, and Colin Sexton will have already theoretically been paid. But when you, I'm surprised that that is in there. I don't think it's like a huge, huge like deal breaker in any regard, but I'm just like a little surprised by it.
Yeah, I mean, definitely a non-guaranteed year always, always benefits the team. There's zero benefit to the player. It's like, it's basically like a team option. It's not exactly. There are some different quirks with it, with a non-guarantee. Like if you waive a guy off of a non-guarantee, you don't get his bird rights like you would if you opted out of a contract. But it's basically, in terms of extending that contract that extra year, the Cavs are the one who will hold the option to do that. Basically, if they waive him, they won't, and if they keep him, then that extends the contract into that year. So letting them have the option, whichever side has the option always is the one who has sort of the power in that year. And so a non-guaranteed year is always a bad thing for a player and a good thing for a team. So that's, you know, another aspect of this that is very surprising for me, for Osman. And you talked about Hield and Brown, and obviously Osman doesn't belong in that conversation in terms of the quality of player, but he does because he's a wing who was going into, you know, restricted free agency next summer, and those guys got paid as if they are going to continue to improve. That's sort of the thing that's how they got paid, you know, especially Jaylen Brown, who had a good, you know, 2017-18, then had a sort of a down year last year, and is going to be paid like he is a, you know, third option on a good team level kind of player, and hasn't really shown that he can consistently do that. You know, Buddy Hield, you know, sort of in the same realm, where he had a great year last year, and he is being paid as if he is going to take that and make it be the baseline of his, you know, play going forward. Osman seems to have agreed to an extension that is not necessarily like baking in future improvement on his part. And he's only 24, and this, you know, this is his third year in the league. So he has a lot of room to grow, and he doesn't, this extension doesn't seem to bake in the possibility that he is going to be much better than he is right now.
I think the other thing about this that I think is reasonable is that I do think, like, if it works out, it's a bargain for the Cavs.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think if you want to talk about this from a Cavs perspective and not the Jetty perspective, which I think we should do, this is like a, if he ends up being like a starting caliber or like wing caliber or like rotation caliber, good player, and on what the Cavs will hope is like a playoff team in 2 to 3 years, that's like a really bargain contract. Even if like we don't know like the implications of the cap from the China situation to like what the whole situation is going to be with, you know, some of the other kind of shenanigans going on right now. I think if he's 27 and good and is making $7.35 million, like that's like really good value. And like to Kobe Altman's credit, like he would have Larry Nance Jr., who will be like, I think 30, 31 at that point, and Jetty locked in at like a combined $16 million. If you have two members of your rotation who are impactful players locked in at that number at that year, that's really good cap management on his part.
Yeah, I mean, if Osman is more than like the seventh man on a good team when the Cavaliers are good again in a few years, that this contract could be like the best contract in the league. Like that's the potential of it. And you know, there's obviously downside if he gets hurt, if he just falls off a cliff, if he doesn't fit with the team as they go forward. There's always downside risk with that, but sort of the median outcome for him is that he'll just sort of stay around this level and he'll be relatively properly paid, but like a useful player on a decent contract, and will sort of, that's sort of the baseline. And then if he blows up in any way, I mean, it's not, he doesn't have to blow up and become Jaylen Brown. Like if he just blows up to the point where instead of being the seventh man on a good team, he's the sixth, fifth, fourth man on a good team, this contract could be one of the best non-max contracts in the league. Like it's really the upside on this contract because of the fact that he's only 2 years in and he's younger at 24. He's got enough upside to explore to make this deal one of the better moves that we've seen in free agency this summer. I mean, even though it didn't technically come in free agency before the season, it's one of the best moves we've seen since July 1st, I think. I mean, it's really based on his past play and what he could be in the future, this deal has so much upside. And it really reminds me of the, what was that contract? 5 years, $35 million that Jay Crowder signed. Maybe now it must be like 2014 or 2015 that he signed that contract. I can't really, I think it was 2015 because he's on the last year of that now. So he signed that 5 year, $35 million contract. And then the cap spiked the next year. And all of a sudden, Jay Crowder, who was like, he was better than Osman was at the time, but obviously the cap was a little bit lower and he was making more money as a proportion of the cap. He signed that contract. And immediately by the next summer, that was like one of the most valuable non-max contracts in the league because he was good and he was being paid this paltry amount for a long time. This is sort of like that. I mean, they basically have him on a 5 year $34 million contract if you bake in this year plus the next four. And he, you know, he has the upside to be the, you know, the fifth option on a good team, the fourth option on the good team. I mean, and even if he's the sixth, you know, even if he's the sixth man, he, you know, he's the first wing off the bench. That's, you know, this is really, really good value for a wing who can be a competent member of your wing rotation on a good team. So, you know, I think it's just, it reminds me of the Jay Crowder contract. I think there's a really good chance that we're going to be talking about it in 3 years, like the Jay Crowder contract. Like this is one of the best non-max, non-superstar contracts in the league. And, you know, I think it's just, it's certainly a home run from that perspective for Altman and the Cavs.
So the other thing I think about this that will be interesting is just Jetty has stuff he clearly, I think, needs to get better on. I think the two things for me, and this is like sort of universal for like every sort of wing player that teams are trying to develop right now, it's his defense and it's his three-point shooting. I think his passing's going to show up a little bit more this year. That's my theory in the B-line system. But I think he needs to, as a defender, I think ideally if he can defend some twos and threes, that'll help him a little bit. I don't know if the Cavs are set up to do that. Like he might have to defend Giannis this week, and that's just like a disaster waiting to happen. And then number two, I think his three-point shooting is just so uneven. His shot's a little inconsistent. His form is. I don't know what the root of that is. I think the player we've seen in international play is just much more steady. So I don't know what the NBA version of Chetty, what the issue sort of is there. But I think if he can iron that out, and I think, you know, one game this season as we record this on Saturday the 26th, you're listening to this probably on the 28th. That is just like the thing for me is if those even out, like this is the thing. And even if he's like, you know, mid-ish 30s three-pointer, like 33 and like is a decent defender when he's not being asked to defend like Lauri Markkanen or Giannis or something, that like works out too. And like you met the Jay Crowder contract is good because in, if you want to look at this from a cap sort of future cap management standpoint, this is something you can probably easily aggregate into other contracts and flip for something else if you wanted to.
Yeah. I mean, he's going to like the Jay Crowder contract was so great because it was value on a small amount of money. And it was because you could lump him in with other contracts and just trade him all over the place. And we've seen that he's been traded like three or four times since he signed that deal. I think he, I can't exactly remember, but I know he was traded from Boston to Cleveland in the Kyrie Irving trade and then traded on to Utah and now is in Memphis. So he's been traded at least three times, maybe a fourth time to get himself to Boston in the first place. I can't totally remember off the top of my head right now, but he's been traded a bunch of times because he's valuable and he's always been a positive value part of those trades. And so I think that's maybe, you know, could be the future for Chetty Osman. I think if Osman sort of isn't what the Cavs exactly need, but is still a good player, he could certainly be moved for positive value pretty much at any point on this contract. So, you know, I think that's something to keep in mind as well. You know, I think the other thing to keep in mind with his three-point shooting is that he took a ton of shots off the dribble last year. And that's a lot. That's, you know, off the dribble shots are much more difficult to hit than catch and shoot shots. So that sort of brought down his three-point percentage as he was sort of asked to be a bigger part of the ball handling aspect of the offense. That is going to naturally lead to more pull-up jump shots. He hit a good percentage of pull-up jump shots compared to other people who hit pull-up jump shots. So, you know, overall, I think his shooting profile sort of is better than just his baseline three-point percentage. You know, 60th percentile in catch and shoot, 60th percentile in pull-up jump shots. It's just that he took a lot of pull-up jump shots and, you know, those are just going to be naturally, you know, more, they're going to be less efficient than catch and shoot jump shots. I think it was the same thing in his rookie year. He took a bunch of catch and shoots, was very good at them, took, you know, some off the dribble and was very, very good at those, but took a lot more catch and shoot because he was playing on the team with LeBron James in 2017-18. Last year, of course, he had more of the ball in his hands, took a lot more pull-up shots. It brought down his overall percentage, but his effectiveness on both catch and shoots and pull-up jump shots were both still above average league-wide for, you know, for those various shot types. So I think his just looking at his three-point percentage is, it might be a little bit misleading because of the types of shots that he took last year.
Yeah, looking on that note, he did not take a single pull-up in the season opener against Orlando. Last season, 12% of his overall shots were pull-up three-pointers. He did weirdly shoot 37% on them, but that's not like a sustainable number. And then he took 32.1% of his three-pointers or overall shots as catch-and-shoot threes, about 34%. Post-All-Star break, just to kind of give you some kind of one-season context, weirdly, he shot even more pull-ups and made 47% of them after the All-Star break. So, like, what? That's just bizarre. But that's not – I don't think that's, like, a sustainable, like, aspect of anyone's game unless you're, like, a really, really elite player. That's not, like – that's not the kind – it's kind of like – to me, it's kind of like a mid-range shot where, like, you – certain elite guys can do it really, really well, but you don't want people, like, making that a big part of their game if they're not, like, an elite, elite player. I think that's just kind of the little difference. The last thing, Jeff, about this – is this does cost the Cavs like a bit of cap space next summer. It's very little. It's not like a significant amount. They still could have a max of about $30.1 million as you tabulated over at Early Bird Rights, projected at about $29.1 million. I think this is interesting because you look at this free agent class, it's not going to be very good. there's a lot of veterans. If I was the Cavs, I would stay away from, I also wouldn't want to like throw a bunch of money at Andre Drummond or something like that. When I look at the list, I wonder if the way to do this is to get guys like to go after guy. I don't, you know, we'll see what Brooklyn probably going to want to keep him and he might want to stay there. But, you know, you look at Joe Harris, you look in the restricted free agent market, you look at Bogdan Bogdanovic from Sacramento. Those are like the there's not a ton of those guys, but those are the type of guys that I'm sort of going to be, I would kind of be taking a look at if I was the Cavs. If you wanted to use that cap space, you know, maybe you bring back Tristan or Delly or something or John Henson or whatever. Bring back one or two of the guys that you're going to lose if you don't trade them. But I think those are the other type of guys that if I'm going to look to spend that money a little bit, it's the Joe Harris, it's the, Bogdanovic. It's that kind of guy that I'd probably be looking at more than anything else.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense. I think if you look around the league as to the teams that are going to have cap space going into next summer, it's Cleveland, it's Atlanta, it's Charlotte, it's Memphis are the big four teams that have a ton of space. New York can get into that derby if they want to. And then there's a couple of teams like Portland who can have some cap space, but not a lot of it. And so I think you look at the big four teams, but even if you include New York, all of those teams are young rebuilding teams who have money. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the unrestricted market, you know, shakes out, because a lot of those guys are older. A lot of those guys don't necessarily fit the timeline of Cleveland or Atlanta or Memphis or Charlotte, where they don't. So those teams don't really need to go after those guys, and they're going to go after sort of the younger, sometimes restricted, depending on where their contract status is at that point. So I think that's another. That's going to be interesting to monitor, obviously, for the Cleveland Cavaliers, just in terms of who can they go after, who can they really get on the market next summer, knowing that there are, you know, other rebuilding teams who are either who might be a little bit further along in Atlanta's case, or are sort of on the same track as them in Memphis's case. So that's certainly that fight is going to be interesting over some of the restricted guys, but it also sort of gets back into Osman knowing that he's going to walk into that sort of market where there are a lot of teams that are rebuilding who might look at him as an answer on the wing, as a young guy who would be sort of on their timeline. That's where I am sort of confused with the Osman extension from his perspective, and why it's such a good deal for the Cavaliers is because the market could have really opened up for him because there are just so few young, you know, either unrestricted or restricted free agents on the market. I think he might have undersold his just sort of market value on the open market next summer.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about that is I look at how I would say in particular, there's three teams in particular I would put in there. I would say it's definitely Memphis, who have Jaren Jackson Jr. and Ja Morant, Atlanta with Trae Young, John Collins, DeAndre Hunter, et cetera, Cam Reddish. I look at those two teams, and then maybe the Cavs, depending on what we learn this year. It's too early for me to say this. But if I'm Atlanta, if I'm Memphis, maybe if I'm the Cavs, I don't think Charlotte's getting there. You're in this position where, like, you have you're kind of key players on cheap contracts. They're not expensive. You can do interesting stuff with them kind of around that. To look at Atlanta, you just drafted Hunter. You just drafted Reddish. We'll see how they work out. Trae Young's only making $6.5 million next year, has a rookie option for $8 million next year. John Collins is only going to be making $4 million next year before he will be restricted free agent next year. Kevin Huerter's making less than $3 million. You look at those things, you look at the cap space you're going to have. If you look at how like NFL teams that have had for cheap first-round quarterbacks on their roster have built, the Browns are doing this, the Chiefs have done this. It's like the roster-building method right now. If you can get that guy and then pay, like, get the veterans to surround that guy for the next couple of years while these guys are still cheap, that to me is a really intriguing thing. And next summer is not a good summer to go do that because there's not a lot of guys that I would be throwing a bunch of money at. But if you can select the right role players and figure out a way to, like, make the cap keep working forward while they're still in your roster and still useful as you keep getting better, and then maybe keep them as your kind of guys get a little more expensive, depending on, you know, your ownership's willingness to pay the tax or whatever – that's like a way forward. I think the problem is, like, again, next summer is not a great class. I mean, there's not a ton of guys that I look at, and I think you feel the same way, that you're like, okay, like I like this player. There's some young, interesting guys you could take flyers on. They're not going to be worth, you know, a bunch of money, probably even less than what Jetty gets. You look like maybe we'll see what Dwayne Bacon kind of looks like. We'll see what I'm drawing a blank on him, but the guy for the Nuggets who didn't come to an agreement on an extension.
Malik Beasley,
like Bogdanovich. Like there's some guys like that, but there's not a ton. But I wonder if that's just kind of a way teams will, in that situation, will kind of approach next summer.
Yeah, and I think the younger teams, Atlanta's almost like basically a year ahead of where, you know, Cleveland and Memphis are because they just sort of, they went in the tank a year ahead of time. And, you know, for Atlanta, the fact that they've got this summer where everybody's real cheap, and then they have 21, 22, where John Collins, instead of being at $4 million, is going to be at $12 million because that's his restricted cap hold. If they decide to extend him, he'll be at whatever number he's at that point, which is probably, I mean, certainly based on his current play, could be $20, $25 million. I mean, he's been one of those guys who they, you know, think that they're going to, you know, build around going forward, you know, assuming that he sort of makes a semi-significant leap defensively, he'll be a part of that core, you know, moving forward. So they've got these next 2 years really to build around their cheap guys before everybody becomes much more expensive after that. You know, Cleveland and Memphis, they've got that extra year. They can push that back another year. So they've got 20, 21, and 22 where they can really do that sort of Chiefs, Browns, you know, team building method where you have cheap guys, you bring in expensive guys over the top. And then when the cheap guys become expensive, you've already got the other expensive guys and you're just, that's how you move forward. That's how you build your team. And that makes a ton of sense. And so I think it's going to be interesting to watch how Cleveland and Memphis approach that over these next couple of years. When do they decide, okay, this is the time to invest? You also have to know that those cheap guys are the ones that you want to build around going forward, because if they're not, it becomes much more difficult to figure out, you know, the cap space to bring in other guys to replace those guys, because you're not going to have a bunch of that if you spend a bunch of money early. So, you know, you have to make sure that Colin Sexton and or Darius Garland are worth building around before you decide to build around them, of course. So, you know, they've got that to figure out. They that's sort of part of what is going to happen this year and next year for Cleveland. You know, in Memphis, I think, you know, Jaren Jackson has proven enough to where he's a piece that you're going to build around. Ja Morant was drafted high enough to where you would think that they are high enough on him that they can build around him. We'll see how he plays in his rookie year. Obviously, in Atlanta, they're already pretty much set with Trey, John, and Kevin Huerter as their three going forward, plus DeAndre Hunter and Cam Reddish, depending on how those guys shake out. So they're both a year ahead, and so that they have, you know, Atlanta's a year ahead, so they have less time to bring in high-level free agents before their guys get properly paid. But they're also a year ahead in development time and know these are our core guys, so we can build around that much easier than a team like Cleveland can, where they're not still 100% sure who their guys absolutely are going forward. So, you know, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how these teams handle, you know, free agency this summer, where there's really not a lot of options, but they still, you know, they don't have to spend that money, but they kind of, you know, they almost always do spend that kind of money. So who do they spend the money on? Who, you know, are there trades to bring in guys, you know, like Cleveland and Atlanta have both done to take on salary? Or is it going to be, you know, balloon payments for veterans that they think are good fits for, you know, a year or two before they, you know, before they want to move on to younger talent who fits their timeline. It's just, you know, I think this is where this kind of summer, the 2020 summer, is where the GMs really earn their money, because it's not just go after the stars and then, you know, figure it out if you miss. It's, you got to figure it out from the beginning. There are no stars. There is nobody who's just like, we have to have this guy. It's really going to be, you really have to do your homework, and you really have to try to either work trades or work, you know, work free agency to fit what your team needs going forward.
You can find Jeff on Twitter at JG Siegel. Check out Early Bird Rights. That's going to where you find any cap sheet you need. He's got it there. Everything is updated in detail. Then he's crazy man and updates immediately. You can read his writing as well over at Peachtree Hoops. Jeff, as always, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
All right, joining me now is Ty Windisch. He is one of the hosts of the Eurostep podcast covering the Milwaukee Bucks. Also covers the the Herd up in the G League up there, the Wisconsin Herd, and also has a Patreon which you can go to, and he's going to analyze every NBA move on that Patreon account. What's going on, man?
Not a whole lot. I'm just a great start to my day here on a Saturday with you doing my plugging for me. Usually I'll sneak in my own plugs, but you took care of it, so I feel great. How are you, Chris?
I'm good. I'm here to plug my guests because if I'm going to ask them to record a podcast with me at a early-ish in the morning and just vamp for whatever amount of time I'm here for. So Cavs play the Bucks on Monday. Just so the listeners know, we are recording this at 10 a.m. Eastern time on Saturday. So the Bucks have only played one game. They're 1-0. They have not played the Miami Heat on this Saturday yet. So, you know, something changes. I'll note that in the intro, but unless something crazy happens, there shouldn't be anything super significant that changes there. When you look at this Bucks season, Giannis is back. You know, you lose Malcolm Brogdon, but you know, you bring back Eric Bledsoe, comes off that playoff run. You bring back George Hill. You bring in the other Lopez brother. You get Wesley Matthews. You bring in Kyle Korver. What do you just sort of expect from this season? What's your big picture kind of expectation for this Bucks team this year? Anything different from last year?
Well, I'm a lot more confident going in just because I saw last season. I mean, I think people tend to forget because the Bucks were just so good last year for pretty much the whole year. Going in, like, even Bucks optimists were like, maybe they can win mid-50s, like, be second or third in the conference, win a playoff series, maybe win two playoff series. And all of a sudden the game start and you can just, like, you just see everything clicked. Like, everything clicked for them. The team finally was shooting and spacing around Giannis, really weaponized him. He wins MVP. The Bucks win 60 games. Obviously, they're not equipped enough to take out the Raptors and make it to the finals. But so I'm more optimistic than last season. And I'll say I think the conference as a whole is easier than last season outside of Philly, which I think I'm a little more worried about Philly, especially in like crunch time and playoff situations than a lot of folks are. But all this to say, I expect the Bucks to make the NBA Finals. I don't expect them to win necessarily. I think a lot of it depends on who comes out of the West. I think there's like just I just think the Clippers, if they're healthy, they're not going to lose to anyone. I think the Clippers are far too good, but I think the Bucks at least should go to the finals this year. So that's my expectation: is Milwaukee wins the East, goes to the finals, and it at least gets there.
What do you make of the roster changes? You know, with Brogdon leaving, with some different pieces coming in, you know, kind of the same structure around Giannis. Obviously, Middleton's still here, but what do you just make of this different looking roster that we're kind of seeing the Bucks kind of roll with this year?
I think there's pluses and minuses to swapping out Brogdon for basically like a combination of Wes Matthews, Korver, and then, I mean, this is a two guard heavy team. So like Pat Connaughton played really well the other night. A lot of people are high on Sterling Brown. Like there's a lot of two guard able players here. Obviously the minus, I mean, 50, 40, 90 player last season. Consistent scorer, one of the best Bucks in a lot of games, or not a lot of games, but in certain playoff moments. But, you know, Brogdon, an injury liability, missed significant games last year, including a lot of the playoff run, and I think around 20 regular season games. And then 2 years ago, I think he only played like 30 games. So that's a concern. Obviously, if you're going to pay a guy like that, you're worried about, you know, if he's not going to be on the floor, then all of a sudden it's really just hampering your cap for no reason. And I mean, when it comes down to it, Brogdon, a good player, but the fifth guy on the Bucks team last year, I think pretty clearly the fifth guy. And I think he really was in a great position to thrive. And I'm rooting for him in Indiana. I hope he does well, but I don't expect him to replicate those 50, 40, 90 numbers when he's the right now the first or second guy. Certainly the second guy when Oladipo comes back. So I think, you know, adding in Wesley Matthews, Korver, whoever else they want to start at the two, those guys can shoot just fine as well. I don't think it's going to hurt the spacing. I think there's moments when you'll miss Brogdon, but my hope since the trade happened has been use those Indiana draft picks to go make some other sort of move to replace him even further if you need to.
When you look at the East this year, it is just really, in my mind, it's most likely just Philly and Milwaukee. I mean, you've already said this at the beginning. You think this team, even if they don't win the finals, they should make the finals. If they did, at the very least, if they don't get the conference finals, like on a like, how much of a disaster is that?
I think it's pretty bad. There's obviously all the hype about Giannis's free agency, all around everything, which is kind of nuts considering he couldn't even hit the market until 2021. But of course, he can decide to sign the Supermax after this year if he would like to. And I think it's been made clear. I mean, he's refuted a lot of the reporting about this. He very much does not want this to be a story. Good luck, Giannis. He doesn't want to talk about it.
Let me just say that. Like, it's a story. It just is. And like, I don't know. I don't even want to talk about like that quote that came out of the Harvard thing. But like, this is just going to be one of those things. I can tell, like, if there's a Bucks fan listening to this, and I can tell you from covering the last LeBron stuff, it's just like it's there, and there's just going to be a lot of people talking, and it's just sort of uncontrollable, and it's not worth putting a lot of your emotional investment into, or like a lot of whatever, and you're going to kind of attention you're going to put into it. But it's there, and it's these are things that aren't just decided like once the season's over. I think if we're being realistic about how the human brain works, like he's going to be thinking about this, even if he's not like whatever he said. Even if that isn't true, like that's just a thing that's part of this.
Yeah, it's sort of a thing. I just some of the constant questions on it, I've always just felt like, and I've maintained this like since KD was obviously an upcoming free agent all of last year. It's like, what is he going to tell you now that's really of value, though? That's my biggest question on talking. And maybe, you know, listen, if Rachel Nichols or whoever wants to talk about it on the studio show, fine. But I really do sympathize with the players getting frustrated. Like, KD probably knew it was out the door, but he can't tell you that. And I really think nobody's mind is made up until the day of. I think that's also how the human brain works. I mean, you can think something for 2 months and then change your mind if something else happens. So I just think, like, there's not a lot of value in asking over and over. But I will say, I really do love the way Giannis has been handling it. Like, Giannis has been trying his hardest to not make it a thing, which I appreciate. But I forgot what I was originally. I don't remember the original question. I don't know what I was talking about at first.
Yeah,
If they don't make it.
Yeah.
No, that'd be bad, though, for sure. Because I think, you know, I said I love the way Giannis has been handling it. I think one of the consistent things about his answers, and that there's the dispute about the Harvard thing, but regardless, I mean, he said before, like, he wants to win. That's the important thing to him. Loyalty is important to him, his family, everything else. Obviously, the Bucks signed Tanasis this year to help with the loyalty and family angles, but the winning is the most important thing. So if the Bucks showed that they came up short, they couldn't win, especially in this East, like if you lose to a Toronto, a Boston, a whoever else, you know, Miami in the playoffs, or I guess even Philly in earlier on. I mean, that's more complicated because they're clearly good. But I think the Bucks should be better. So I think that would be bad. And then all of a sudden you're concerned. You still have basically a year left to try and convince him the next year. But then the noise is going to be so much louder. So I think, you know, like the last 3 years, everyone keep like, there's so much. This is the pressure year for the Bucks, to keep you honest. Like, I guess they're just all going to be a pressure year now. I don't think there's any non-pressure years when you have an MVP player on your roster. I mean, you're always trying to convince them that you're worthy of his time and his energy. So, you know, is it, you know, stressful? Is it annoying? I wouldn't say annoying. It's stressful for sure. I think LeBron kind of made it annoying for the Cavs that last year. But is it like, would I trade this for, you know, the pre-Giannis years? No, absolutely not. I'll keep the stress of worrying about it and also getting to have Giannis on my team in the meantime.
No, I think that's fair. Any in terms of the actual Encore product, and you look at what Budenholzer doing either offensively, defensively, any adjustments? I mean, it's one game, but from the preseason, from what he said from that one game, anything different about how the Bucks played, they are playing this year versus how they played last year?
Bud like says like nothing ever. I think this is a running joke among the Bucks beat writers. Like, you just don't get anything out of him, but. From what I noticed from game one, there were a couple things, because, you know, that's the knock on Bud, right? He doesn't adapt. He has this great system and it wins you 60 games and you blow the doors off the Pistons and then the Celtics after one game. And then it gets gummed up against Toronto and there's just nothing, like there's no valve, there's no recourse, there's no switch up basically to it. I saw a couple things that I really liked, even just in game one. Giannis and Chris ran a couple of sort of pick and roll actions that worked well. That's been something I've been yelling about forever. It's like they're the Bucks' best two players. A lot of different guys end up guarding both of them. Run them through some pick and rolls, confuse the defenses, get Giannis some better looks, and just run Giannis more pick and rolls no matter what. I mean, he's 97 plus percentile on both ends of pick and rolls. Like, he just doesn't do it enough, but he's really, really freaking good at it. So I saw some of that, which was encouraging. And then late in the game, Giannis fouls out in game one with about 5 minutes left against Houston's home opener. And they posted up Brooke Lopez over PJ Tucker and I think Harden like four times in a row late. And, you know, he passed out of a couple of them. He scored a couple times. He got fouled once, I think. That was super encouraging because that was not something the Bucks turned to much at all last year. I mean, they would not like get out of their system, like interrupt their usual fare to do that. And I think seeing that they just had an obvious mismatch and going and exploiting it over and over and over, that to me was very encouraging. I would love to see more of that. You know, as everyone's so caught up in Brooks' defense now and his three-point shooting, the guy has not forgotten how to post up. The guy is still big, a large human being, even by NBA standards. So I love some of that where if like a team tries to go small, you know what? Post him up with Brooke Lopez. Use Brooke Lopez and don't just get caught up doing the same things over and over if things get sticky. So I was actually pretty encouraged by what I thought were a couple of deviations from the standard, like, you know, four out around Giannis, don't run that much stuff and just hope Giannis figures it out that we're used to.
Last thing, looking at Monday's game, it's again the Cavs. These are teams at different stratospheres. For me, the one thing I want to see from the Cavs side is I just want to see like what they try to do to defend Giannis because they don't have like an obvious candidate. I wonder if it's going to be like Tristan Thompson and Larry Nance doing it, and we'll kind of see what that could look like. But when you look at this game, what is just something you're kind of looking to kind of just seeing how it might play out on Monday in Milwaukee?
I'm excited to see some of the former Bucks. John Henson, someone who I always enjoyed watching, even though he wasn't, you know, the best or most consistent player. I'm a Brandon Knight stan, so I'm excited about that. And I want to watch these Cleveland guards as well, Sexton and Garland, Sexland, if you will. But yeah, watching to see how they're going to try and defend Giannis is going to be super interesting. Like maybe Alphonso McKinney gets involved. Is Sindarius Thornwell still? Is he
no, so they waived him at the end of camp, which for me, I'll just say this. Like I think he would have been the best defender of the team. I think he's a better wing defender than McKinney. I don't quite – I think aside from the fact that, like, they just are going to have a lot of young wings they want to play, I don't really get the logic of not having him on there because he would have been the best wing defender they have. Maybe they think McKinney's a better overall player. I think Thornwell would have been the best wing defender. I don't quite understand, like, cutting him when that's, like, the only option you really have there. But maybe it doesn't matter.
Probably not. It's still an interesting choice. I wonder if they'll use Jetty on Giannis at all. I'm not sure.
I think you may see that, but like just think about the strength difference.
Yeah.
Like Nwaba did it a lot last year. I think it was Nwaba who's now in the Nets and Tristan. I think and Nance were kind of the guys that, if I remember correctly, were the ones kind of doing that job last year. Which is like it's a really hard job. Like, how many guys in the league actually can like defend Giannis well? It's like.
So I will say I'll look for this if they – yeah, there's not a lot. It's a short list. Kawhi, number one. Yeah, probably around there. A couple guys. Ayton does kind of well, but I think Giannis is going to, like, punish Ayton this year if he's not suspended for both Bucks games because Ayton, like, Giannis got frustrated with teams putting centers on him, not because he couldn't score, but he was like – I think he said this S expletive isn't – it doesn't work, which was, like, a great Giannis moment for me. But I will say this is something to look forward to for Cavs fans. Giannis has been shooting more this year. He's 2-for-5 in the opener. So I will say if they try to use Tristan and Nance, I'm sure those guys will at least to start sag off of him. Be interesting to watch how much Giannis pulls up on those opportunities from like 3-point range. Because I think the answer will be often and it'll be great. It'll be like a little game within the game thing to me to see how those like the defenders and Giannis adjust to each other in terms of, you know, at first I'm sure sagging off him, waiting for the drive. If he starts shooting, if he makes a couple, it'll be interesting to see if they change their tactics on him, if they just try to defend him closer to the three-point line, which, you know, is dangerous. Like Tristan Thompson trying to defend Giannis at the top of the key doesn't seem good for Tristan Thompson. I don't know. It'll be fun to watch. It's always fun to see how teams without that typical wing defender guard Giannis because there's not a lot of good options with a guy like that.
You can find him on Twitter at Ty Windisch. That is TiWindisch. I think I spelled that correctly off the top of my head. Did I?
You did. Yeah, you got the C, so we're good.
Look at me out here killing it on a Saturday. But find his Patreon at that same name. Check out the Eurostep podcast and check out his herd coverage. Just give him a follow on Twitter. You'll learn a lot about the Bucks. And Ty, thank you so much for coming on.
Chris, thanks a ton. I had a blast as usual.